Chapter 5. Castro's Beard. As a rule, covert action is carried out by the same officers in each station who normally collect intelligence. It is coordinated by the covert action staff within the Directorate of Operations. In addition, the Directorate has a Special Activities Operations staff that conducts paramilitary activities, such as those in Afghanistan. One officer estimates that overall, 75% of the time of operations officers in the field is devoted to gathering intelligence, and the rest to covert action. Today, covert action accounts for only 3% of the national foreign intelligence budget, roughly $500 million, or 15% of the CIA's budget. But covert action accounts for most of the black eyes the agency has received. In the beginning, there were many successes, or what seemed to be successes. In 1948, the CIA funded the Christian Democrats in Italy, helping to prevent communists from taking over the Italian government. In 1950, Colonel Edward G. Lansdale, who was on loan to the CIA from the Air Force, helped the Philippine leader Ramon Magsaysay overcome the communist-backed Hook guerrillas. On August 21, 1953, the CIA, led by Kermit Roosevelt, overthrew the left-wing government of Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran after he nationalized the British-owned Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. 3 days later, the Shah, who had fled the previous week, returned to the palace. Buoyed by these triumphs, the U.S. became more aggressive. America interpreted the most innocuous developments as further evidence that the Soviet Union was about to encircle the world. In June 1954, the CIA supported the overthrow of Jacobar Benz of Guatemala after he nationalized 400,000 acres of idle banana plantation land owned by United Fruit Company. Arbenz had offered some $600,000, precisely what the company had declared as the land's value for tax purposes. Moreover, he had come to power in popular elections. But Arbenz's left-leaning politics and the fact that some of the people around him were communists were seen by Washington as reasons enough to overthrow him. In most cases, the benefits of covert action were only temporary. Arbenz was replaced by even more objectionable and often ruthless leaders. Guatemala has been in turmoil ever since. In Iran, the Shah lasted more than 25 years and was toppled and replaced by the Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979. While 25 years of stability is a great feat, the CIA action in installing the Shah identified Iran and the Shah more closely with the U.S. than was good for either of them, Gregory Treverton wrote in his book, Covert Action. It also set in motion a kind of psychological dependence by the Shah on the United States that Americans no doubt liked initially, but came to lament in 1977 and 1978. Meanwhile, the Soviets used the CIA's meddling in the affairs of other countries to great effect. The U.S. was seen as imperialistic and hypocritical. What more evidence was needed than the fact that it would overthrow a legally elected leader? David A. Phillips, a CIA officer who played a major role in the ouster of Arbenz, would later say that on balance, the CIA should not overthrow an elected leader. Defenders of covert action would say we are fighting to preserve liberty and democracy and the American way, said Simmons, a former CIA officer who was later staff director of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. But when you get into the details, you wonder if they are talking about the same thing. He may be an SOB and a dictator, but he is our SOB, whereas Arbenz, who was democratically elected, was not an SOB, but he wasn't ours. On April 17, 1961, the CIA began the invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs. It would be a dismal failure. The Directorate of Operations was so fixated on secrecy that it did not consult the CIA's Directorate of Intelligence for an assessment of whether the Cuban people would rise up against Castro once an invasion began. If it had, the judgment would have been that the Cubans would not support the invasion. Just before the invasion, CIA analysts had concluded that Castro was likely to grow stronger rather than weaker as time goes by. One CIA memo warned that Castro now has established a formidable structure of control over the daily lives of the Cuban people. Thanks in part to last-minute restrictions by President Kennedy, the CIA did not have enough firepower to pull off the invasion. While the Directorate of Operations kept the operation from other CIA components, the The word quickly leaked out to the rest of the world. Even the New York Times knew about it, but agreed not to publish the story. Finally, the CIA had the unrealistic notion that an invasion could be mounted by Cuban expatriates without Cuba's knowing that the U.S. government was backing them. My own personal view is that almost the worst mistake we made on that operation was clinging to the belief that this could be done in a way that was not attributable to the U.S. government, Richard M. Bissell, Jr., a former Yale University and MIT professor of economics, who headed the invasion as the CIA's deputy director for operations, said. Clinging to the idea that if our tradecraft was good, nobody could connect it to the U.S. government, that was just an utterly unattainable and a very silly hope. Anything of that magnitude would be blamed on the U.S. government, even if the U.S. had not had a role in it. But we paid a high price for disclaimability in terms of operational capability, Bissell said. We weren't allowed to use volunteer U.S. air crews. We therefore didn't have enough air crews. We therefore didn't assemble enough B-26 bombers. We couldn't take off from any American-held territory such as Puerto Rico. There was a whole list of things. We weren't allowed to have any volunteer Americans go ashore with the brigade. That would have been a major benefit. So I think that from top to bottom we made that mistake. Nonetheless, under pressure from President Kennedy, the CIA in December 1961 began a range of other covert actions aimed at toppling Castro, each more foolish than the last. A CIA Inspector General's report of August 25, 1967, recounts dozens of bungled attempts to assassinate Castro or embarrass him with his people. Under one such plan, the CIA would spray the air of a radio station where Castro broadcast his speeches with a chemical that would produce hallucinatory reactions similar to LSD. Another scheme was designed to contaminate cigars smoked by Castro with a chemical that would create temporary personality disorientation. A third idea was to introduce thallium salt into Castro's shoes so his beard would fall out. This, according to CIA plotters, would destroy his public image. Finally, the CIA proposed setting off fireworks off the coast of Cuba that would portray an image of Christ in the sky, this to show that Castro was in disfavor with God. The stupidest scheme was to enlist the aid of the mafia in killing Castro. Bissell, the deputy director for operations, asked Sheffield Edwards, director of security, to contact mafia leaders for the purpose. Edwards enlisted Robert A. Mayhew, a private investigator, who asked John Rosselli, an associate of mafia leaders, to offer up to $150,000 to remove Castro. Rosselli agreed to contact Salvatore Sam Giancana, a member of the mafia, and Giancana asked for a lethal pill that could be given to Castro in his food. The CIA produced pills containing botulinum toxin for Castro. The CIA passed the pills to the mafia, but the gangsters reported they could not carry off the plot because their source had lost his position in the Prime Minister's office. The CIA also developed plans that were never carried out to assassinate Patrice Lumumba, who headed what was then known as the Congo and is now called Zaire. Today, assassination plots are banned. The first presidential prohibition was contained in Executive Order 11905, signed by President Gerald Ford on February 18, 1976. It said no government employee could participate in attempts to kill foreign leaders. Executive Order 12333, signed by President Reagan on December 4, 1981, governs the CIA's activities today. It states, no person employed by or acting on behalf of the U.S. government shall engage in, or conspire to engage in, assassination. After fumbling in Cuba, the CIA went on to try to control elections in Chile. In 1964, the agency spent $2.6 million to support the election of the Christian Democratic candidate, Eduardo Frei, to prevent Salvador Allende's accession to the presidency. In 1970, the CIA tried to mount a military coup in Chile to prevent confirmation of Salvador Allende's victory in the Chilean presidential election. It also spent $8 million to prevent his confirmation, all in vain. The CIA also became involved in covert action and paramilitary actions in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Angola, Afghanistan, and Nicaragua. Only in Afghanistan was the CIA's intervention considered entirely successful. It would be easy, as some CIA officers do, to blame the presidents at the time for urging the agency to undertake covert action that was ill-advised. Nearly every one was approved by presidents and policymakers who were looking for a quick fix for the problem of the day. We cannot overemphasize the extent to which responsible agency officers felt themselves subject to the Kennedy administration's severe pressure to do something about Castro and his regime, the CIA Inspector General's report on the plots said. The fruitless and, in retrospect, often unrealistic plotting should be viewed in that light. But that is not the whole story. The agency often encouraged the White House to think that covert action would work, then developed ill-advised schemes to carry it out. Too often, not enough thought was given to what was to be accomplished, whether it would work, and what would happen if the CIA's involvement became public, as it invariably did. In CIA lingo, such bad publicity is known as blowback or flap. CIA officers often pursued covert action for the sake of doing something, without giving much thought to the possible consequences. As a result of the Church Committee hearings in 1975 and 1976, strong congressional oversight put a stop to many of the ill-conceived schemes. But under CIA Director William Casey, some bizarre or highly risky covert actions were again approved, or at least considered. The prime example was the Iran-Contra plan to exchange arms for hostages. While the CIA itself did not arrange it, Casey and National Security Council aide Lieutenant Colonel Oliver L. North Jr. used a few individuals in the agency to carry out the scheme. In 1985, the CIA provided training and communications equipment to Lebanese intelligence officers who claimed they were anti-terrorists and would help free William Buckley, the former CIA station chief in Beirut who had been kidnapped on March 16, 1984. President Reagan approved the plan in a written intelligence finding, the formal authorization required before covert action can be carried out. The document giving presidential approval to a covert action is referred to as a finding because it begins, "I hereby find that the following activities are important to the national security of the United States." But John McMahon, the deputy director of Central Intelligence, opposed it, saying the former intelligence officers were not to be trusted, and the CIA ran the risk of supporting people who might kill others. According to McMahon, Casey then asked President Reagan to withdraw the finding, and the CIA never went ahead with the project. But the officers who were to get the aid hatched their own plan to kill Sheikh Mohammed Hussein Fadlallah, who headed a Shiite terrorist movement called Hezbollah, or Party of God. It was this group that was believed to be holding Buckley. 80 people were killed on March 8, 1985, when a car filled with explosives was left near Fadlallah's apartment house in a Beirut suburb. Fadlallah escaped without any injury, and the CIA was unfairly blamed for having ordered the assassination attempt. When that happened, I went to Bill Casey and said, "See, goddammit, that's exactly what I mean. That's what happens with these guys. We weren't associated with it, but we got blamed for it," McMahon said. The same kind of problem occurred in Operation Phoenix, a program run by William Colby during the Vietnam War to identify Viet Cong hidden within the South Vietnamese population. Both American and South Vietnamese intelligence agencies collected the intelligence, then turned the information over to the South Vietnamese. In most cases, the South Vietnamese incarcerated and questioned the Viet Cong, but in some cases they killed them. As a result, the operation developed a reputation as an assassination squad, even though that was not its intent. Moreover, casualties that arose from military actions were often attributed to the program. More recently, in Suriname, Casey decided the CIA should overthrow Désiré Dubuterte as the leader of the South American country because the government was killing opposition leaders and permitting the country to be used as a transshipment point for cocaine. This plan, too, never got off the ground after it hit opposition both in Congress and the administration. "We were worried about what was going on there," McMahon said. "The question was, should we do it militarily or do it ourselves? We tried to round up enough people to go carry it out. It did fall by the wayside, and I don't think it was just because of the House or Senate. There were a lot in the administration who had some misgivings on it. But the agency gave it a college try and started drawing up plans on how to go about it." Today, only a dozen covert action programs are carried out each year. Some of them are broad strategies that may be undertaken in a number of countries. Most of them are low-level propaganda efforts or innocuous aid to countries fighting terrorism or narcotics. For example, at the request of these countries, the CIA may provide weapons, vehicles, training, and databases for checking on travelers going through customs. The only reason the funding is covert is that the countries themselves do not want their own people to know the United States is helping to combat narcotics or terrorism. The CIA's propaganda efforts usually consist of printing books for distribution in the former Soviet Union or planting articles favorable to the United States or American ideals in countries where the media is anti-American. During the Vietnam War, we would present anything that made the Soviets or North Vietnamese look bad, a former CIA officer said. It may not necessarily be untrue, or it might be facts that otherwise might not get into print. The Soviets do that all the time. Truth is generally thought to be a better weapon in propaganda efforts. In a lot of places you can't get anything in the paper that is pro-American. Everything is pro-Soviet, so they only know that side. In contrast to the days before the Church Committee hearings, the CIA today tends to be reluctant to undertake covert action. It has to be done on a case-by-case basis, a former National Security Council aide said. There have been cases where it has been extremely effective. There are others where it didn't make any difference at all. In some cases, it probably was counterproductive. That depends on what is being implemented, how it is implemented, and what your goals and policies are. Virtually every covert action eventually becomes public, often creating more harm than good because of the poor image it projects of the U.S. I would estimate that well over half of the covert action programs on the books have, at least in a general sense, been identified in the press in some fashion. Not all the details and all the methods, according to Russell J. Broomer, a former CIA general counsel under William Webster. Probably almost all of the controversial ones have been identified. The cumulative effect of CIA covert action over the years has been that when anything negative happens, the CIA is blamed. Thus, after the assassination of Rajiv Gandhi by a female South Asian suicide bomber in May 1991, leading Indian newspapers and government officials, perhaps unwilling to blame themselves, became firmly convinced that the CIA had ordered him killed. It is a difficult opinion to explain or refute, since it seems to arise not from evidence or even coherent speculation, but from a deep-seated emotional conviction, according to a Washington Post news analysis from New Delhi. Why do people find it easy to believe Dave Phillips killed Kennedy? I knew Dave well. There's not one chance that he would ever have been involved with such a thing. Yet he was a division chief, so he was an obvious target for that kind of accusation. People believe it because he was CIA, former CIA officer Simmons said. At the same time, covert action more than anything else has tarnished the image of the CIA at home, making it more difficult to recruit the best personnel and to obtain the best consultants from the academic world. The negative attitude toward intelligence within academic circles, I think, has to do with tying the intelligence community to the failures of covert action, Russell J. Bowen, a retired CIA analyst who continues to consult for the agency, said. We've had a tremendous amount of exposure to questionable covert action. That overshadows what is done positively by the analytical side of the house. In principle, I think we ought to discourage the idea of fighting secret wars or even initiating most covert operations, George W. Ball, Undersecretary of State in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, has said. When the United States violates those principles, when we mine harbors in Nicaragua, we fuzz the difference between ourselves and the Soviet Union. In the last analysis, covert action has contributed very little to strengthening the national security of the U.S. If an action is worth taking, it should be done openly, as the U.S. did in driving Iraq from Kuwait during the Persian Gulf War. In pursuing covert action, the U.S. perpetuates the myth that its clandestine activities will remain secret, while avoiding asking itself the tough questions it would normally ask before taking action in the open. Those questions frequently lead to the conclusion that the action is not worth the risk. Like an elephant crapping during a circus, covert action is a sideshow to the CIA's main activities, one that grabs all the attention and, in the long run, does more harm than good. In contrast, intelligence gathering, the bread and butter of the CIA, is a relatively benign activity. While it entails breaking the espionage laws of other countries, it does not as a rule lead to violence or intervention in the affairs of other countries. By finding out more about each other, countries such as the U.S. and the former Soviet Union promote peace by preventing the kind of paranoia that might lead to a first strike. For that reason, no CIA activity has been so important to U.S. security as finding out what is going on inside the Soviet Union. Chapter 6. Weather Balloons. For 40 years, the CIA's primary target was the Soviet Union, and with good reason. After World War II, Joseph Stalin, the Soviet leader, declared the Soviet Union a denied area and began building up the country's military. In speeches, he implied that war was inevitable between capitalist and communist countries. In 1944, the Soviets overran Hungary. By 1947, the Soviets had taken over in Poland and Romania. In 1948, a communist coup succeeded in Czechoslovakia, and Soviet harassment of Western traffic into Berlin had become a blockade. Finally, in 1950, North Korea, supported by communist China, invaded the South. To suppress dissent at home, the Soviets established a secret police, the forerunner of the KGB, that brutally repressed the populace at home and became an effective and fearsome intelligence threat abroad. The U.S. government was convinced the Soviets would attack Western Europe next, and even America. If it was a life-or-death struggle, it was also a frustrating one because it was so difficult to find out what was going on behind what Winston Churchill had dubbed the Iron Curtain. The Soviets declared their country closed. Without spy satellites or high-flying planes such as the U-2, the CIA knew virtually nothing about what was happening inside the Soviet Union. In the absence of knowledge, fear took over. Even the most elementary facts were unavailable, on roads and bridges, on the location and production of factories, on city plans and airfields, according to Harry Rositsky, a former CIA officer in charge of operations against the Soviet Union in the 1940s and 1950s. Scores of Air Force researchers were compiling Soviet bombing target dossiers from out-of-date materials in the Library of Congress. The first real big question we had, which came out of the Korean War, was how big is the Soviet Union, a former CIA Soviet analyst said. We had identified our enemy as the Soviet Union, but we didn't know anything about it. They had stopped any information. There was a great experiment, a new system. We didn't know if it was working or not. How big were they relative to us in terms of their GNP? Were they growing rapidly or were they standing still? The CIA asked those few travelers who were allowed into the Soviet Union to look for missile sites. They never found any. The agency tried to piece together captured German aerial photographs of Soviet territory. It showed where construction had started on military installations, but was out of date. In desperation, the CIA began parachuting agents from airplanes behind Soviet lines. Because they had no diplomatic immunity, they could be executed if caught. Because of the rigid control the Soviets maintained over their society, it was virtually impossible to infiltrate foreigners into the country. As far as the CIA knows, all the illegals were caught. Another CIA ploy was to send reconnaissance balloons equipped with cameras 50,000 feet over the Soviet Union and Communist China, hoping that some would drift to the other side of the country and bring back photos of military installations or factories. To give them the appearance of weather balloons, the CIA outfitted them with signs in Russian asking for their return for meteorological research. Based on estimates of how long the balloons would take to cross Asia, a timer unfurled a parachute that would float the film to Earth. Following a radio signal, Air Force planes could intercept the package and retrieve it. If they missed it, a transmitter continued to signal the location of the package for 24 hours. The Soviets shot down some of the balloons, while others fell inside Soviet territory or landed in Poland. In all, 516 balloons were launched. Of these, 40 returned 13,813 photos of Soviet and Communist Chinese territory, covering about 8% of their land mass. The U.S. stopped the program after the Soviets held a press conference and displayed 50 of the captured balloons. The CIA's most immediate concern was developing some system for detecting an imminent attack. In that event, steam locomotives would have to be fired up and flat cars would be needed to ship tanks. So the CIA recruited people in railroad dispatchers' offices. The agency knew where the railroad cars were located and what their normal travel patterns were. The CIA also debriefed defectors and other émigrés. A former prostitute told the agency about the location of a missile site near Moscow. According to her, she could see the missiles while on the way to her assignations in military barracks. The CIA's first major recruitment of a Soviet intelligence operative came in 1952, when Lieutenant Colonel Peter Popov of the GRU, the Soviet Military Intelligence Agency, offered in Vienna to spy for the agency. Besides giving away identities of Soviet intelligence officers, Popov delivered, according to William Hood, his case officer, one of the Pentagon's highest priority targets, a copy of the 1947 Soviet Army Field Regulations. The following year, the CIA built the Berlin Tunnel, which tapped into Soviet telephone calls in East Germany. The tunnel was 600 yards long, 6 feet high, and 15 feet underground. The lines, 432 in all, connected the Soviet High Command in East Berlin to the General Staff and Foreign Office in Moscow and all major Red Army units in East Germany, Soviet diplomatic installations, and Soviet intelligence headquarters in East Berlin. The interceptions provided the CIA with the complete order of battle of the Soviet group of forces in East Germany, as well as comments of Soviet officers about their troops in the field. In 1961, Colonel Oleg Penkovsky, a Soviet GRU officer, approached the British in Moscow. When he next visited London the following year, he began spying for the West. For 16 months, he provided MI6 and the CIA with running accounts of Soviet military strategies, the capabilities of the missiles that touched off the Cuban Missile Crisis in October 1962, and details of KGB and GRU operations targeted against the U.S. In addition, he gave the CIA a series of articles from a top-secret military magazine that had asked Soviet military leaders to express their views on policy. The articles provided insight into the Soviet military mind. Kovsky had initially approached a CIA officer in Moscow, but the CIA, thinking he was a Soviet plant, rejected him. After another unsuccessful attempt with a Canadian, he eventually approached Grenville Wynne, a former British intelligence officer who was visiting Moscow on business. Wynne introduced the GRU officer to the British MI6. The CIA then agreed jointly to finance and run the operation with the British. The CIA's initial rejection of Penkovsky illustrates how effectively the Soviets protected their citizens from recruitment by the CIA. Almost any Soviet could be a potential KGB informer, and the CIA was constantly on the lookout for provocations that would result in expulsions of CIA officers assigned to Moscow. Today, the CIA recognizes that it is better to err on the side of accepting an agent, even if it means a CIA officer will occasionally be expelled because of a provocation. In trying to penetrate the Soviets, the CIA's Directorate of Operations had to rely almost entirely on Soviets who volunteered to spy, either as recruitments in place or as defectors. "With Soviets, they mostly fall into your hands. You don't recruit them," a former operations officer said. At any given time, the CIA had no more than 24 assets or agents in the Soviet Union. One of the most important was Adolf G. Tolkachev, a Soviet scientist whose information saved the U.S. Navy billions of dollars by providing the CIA with information that showed that the United States and its allies were moving in the wrong direction in developing systems for detecting and combating Soviet submarines. For many years, Tolkachev left photographs of Soviet military technical plans and specifications every 2 months in ever-changing CIA drop sites in Moscow. Typically, the film was concealed in fake rocks or dog droppings containing secret compartments ingeniously fashioned by the CIA's Office of Technical Service. Other key recruitments were Viktor I. Shamov and Alexander D. Ogorodnik. Shamov worked in the KGB's 8th Chief Directorate, which handles communications intelligence. He defected in 1980 after working for several years as a CIA agent or recruitment in place. Ogorodnik, a Soviet diplomat, reported on internal Soviet deliberations. and Vladimir I. Vitrov, who had the cryptonym Farewell, reported to Western intelligence services that the Soviets had placed bugs on the printers used by the French intelligence service for communications. That led to closer examination of typewriters used to write sensitive memos at the American embassy in Moscow, and the discovery of the same kinds of bugs. Many other agents recruited by the CIA among Soviets either retired in place or defected without any publicity. Because it is so difficult to move in Moscow without being detected, CIA officers assigned to Moscow station rarely recruit agents. Instead, they service dead drops for agents who were previously recruited when they traveled overseas or who volunteered while in Moscow. For example, Ogorodnik was enlisted to spy for the CIA when he was based in Venezuela. CIA officers who pick up film or leave money or equipment in dead drops in Moscow often are not the officers assigned to the case. Rather, they are the personnel who seem least subject to Soviet surveillance that day. When the Cold War was at its peak, the Soviet East Europe Division may have seemed to be the most prestigious place to be assigned. But without agents to recruit, CIA officers in Moscow often came out looking second best. While CIA officers there are merely picking up documents from agents recruited by others, another guy is recruiting in Africa as if he's picking bananas off a tree. So all these guys are rated in competition with each other. You look and say you have to recruit agents, a former operations officer said. The press thinks SE, Soviet East Europe Division, is more elite, a former officer assigned to the division said. But there's usually no scramble to join it because of the drawbacks. Most of what CIA officers do in Moscow isn't spectacular. They'll service dead drops and walk miles to locate sites. In most parts of the world, CIA officers use the State Department's political, consular, or economic sections as cover. But to make the KGB's surveillance job more difficult in Moscow, CIA officers are spread through more government agencies there. In Moscow, CIA officers may use as cover the military or the U.S. Information Agency, for example. The State Department's laxity in maintaining security at the American Embassy in Moscow has contributed to the problem. Because the State Department shipped typewriters to the old embassy on Soviet trains and allowed them to remain in Soviet warehouses, the KGB was able to implant bugging devices that transmitted the contents of classified memos to a nearby KGB listening post. The bugs in the typewriters were secreted in a horizontal aluminum bar in the typewriter's casings. The bar had been sliced in half and then resealed so the seam was barely visible. Because the devices were roughly the same density as the typewriter's casings, ordinary X-rays could not detect them. Routine electronic sweeps of the embassy had not detected the bugs either. The bugs stored data and transmitted it only intermittently. The Soviets controlled when the bugs dumped or transmitted information, and they could turn them off when a sweep might be in progress. Moreover, the coded signals used the same frequency as a Moscow television station. When the bugs transmitted, viewers heard momentary static. Since the signals were on the same wavelengths as the television station, sweeps of the embassy detected nothing. The Americans found the bugs only by using highly sophisticated scanning devices that bombard material with neutrons. Meanwhile, the Soviets planted bugs in the new American embassy. They were so ingeniously designed that they were a part of the building's structure and could not be removed. A primary purpose of the electronic penetrations was to find out what the CIA was doing so the Soviets could take action against the agency. Over the years, dozens of CIA officers have been expelled from Moscow for spying. In March 1983, the Soviets declared Richard W. Osborne, a first secretary of the embassy, persona non grata. The Soviets said at the time that they caught him with spy equipment, including radio equipment for transmitting espionage information via the U.S. Marisat communication satellites. Marisat is the Maritime Communications Satellite System, which is used for commercial and Navy transmissions. The Soviets said they also seized Osborne's own notes, which were written in a pad made of paper that quickly dissolved in water. In June 1983, the Soviets expelled Louis C. Thomas, an attaché and electronics expert, saying they caught him red-handed in a spying operation. In March 1985, they expelled Michael C. Sellers, a second secretary of the embassy. To buttress the case for the expulsion and to embarrass the CIA, Izvestia ran a photo of him disguised as a Ukrainian, wearing a false mustache and a wig. Paul M. Stomba, a second secretary, was expelled in June 1985. The Soviets said he had been caught taking documents from Adolf G. Tolkachev, who was later executed by a firing squad. According to TASS, U.S. intelligence agencies had given Tolkachev miniature cameras for photographing secret documents, two-way radios, encoding devices, and special poisons. Tolkachev had been compromised by Edward Lee Howard, a former CIA officer who defected to Moscow after the CIA fired him over drug and alcohol use. The Soviets have few, if any, female KGB officers, and they always seem surprised when the Americans use them. So the CIA has tended to use many women in Moscow. One, Martha Peterson, was expelled in 1977 after she was caught acting as the operations officer for Ogorodnik. One CIA officer was expelled while testing the RT-804 transmitter, which sends 10,000 characters to satellites in coded bursts that last only a few seconds. The same model had been confiscated by Cuban intelligence several years earlier. The Soviets expelled another CIA officer after he paid off a man who had been sent to Moscow years earlier as a contract employee, then disappeared. The man resurfaced in the early 1980s. He claimed the Soviets had imprisoned him and had set him free after he had served time in prison. Now he said he wanted his back salary from the CIA. The CIA decided to make contact with the man, knowing it might be a provocation, but feeling obligated to pay him since he had indeed been a CIA agent for many years. But the CIA's loyalties had been misplaced. The man had apparently been working for the Soviets all along. When a CIA officer approached the meeting site with money in hand, the KGB was waiting for him. The CIA, with the help of NSA, intercepted a variety of civilian and military communications in Moscow. Besides equipment installed on the top floor of the American Embassy in Moscow, the CIA used a device planted inside a tree stump outside of Moscow to pick up microwave transmissions and relay them to other receivers. Another device was installed in a sewer and tapped military telephone lines. The Soviets eventually discovered both devices. While the CIA has always applauded officers who successfully recruit agents overseas, it has tended to treat those who handle defectors as babysitters. As a rule, defectors simply walk into an embassy and volunteer themselves. No cunning is required to elicit their cooperation, so no plaudits are handed out to the officers who bring them in and handle them. Yet defectors can provide information just as valuable as agents who remain in place. Because they can be debriefed more leisurely, their information is usually far more comprehensive. It was these institutional attitudes that contributed to the redefection of Vitali S. Yurchenko, who was easily the most important KGB officer to defect to the United States. After 93 days in the hands of the CIA, Yurchenko returned to the Soviet Union in 1985, claiming he had been kidnapped and drugged. In fact, the CIA had mishandled him, treating him coldly and assigning to him guards from the Office of Security who routinely treated him as a prisoner. Under William Webster, defector handling was upgraded. In 1990, he appointed a respected intelligence officer from the Soviet East European Division to head the resettlement center and coordinate debriefing of defectors. With strong backing from Webster, the officer took charge of defector handling and doubled the size of the defector handling staff to 60 employees, including clerical personnel. The staff now includes a full-time psychiatrist and a full-time psychologist to help defectors adjust. A financial advisor has been added to help defectors with the management of their funds. Each defector is now given 2 weeks of instruction in American life. A senior officer keeps in touch with chief executive officers of major corporations in order to place defectors in jobs. Because of all the difficulties associated with recruiting agents in Moscow, some of the most fruitful operations directed against the Soviet Union have taken place in other countries. While these operations are carried out by local stations, they are coordinated by the Soviet East Europe Division within the Directorate of Operations. SE Division is divided into four main groups: the CI Group, which is responsible for counterintelligence matters; the Internal Operations Group, which focuses on operations within the Soviet bloc; The External Operations Group, which focuses on Soviet bloc activities elsewhere in the world, and the Reports Group, which processes intelligence reporting on the Soviet Union. In addition, a support branch oversees security, office furnishings, equipment, and personnel matters. A member of the staff of the chief of SE Division is in charge of covert action, mainly publishing of books and other press material within the Soviet Union. The books are not traceable to the CIA. A key goal of the Soviet East Europe Division has been acquisition of Soviet military equipment, which may be uncovered in the most unlikely places. For example, when the Soviets left Ghana in 1966, they abandoned equipment that the CIA obtained. For a decade, the agency also procured some of the latest Soviet weaponry through the family of the late Romanian dictator Nicolae Ceausescu. The Defense Department publishes a classified list of Soviet equipment and parts it would like to obtain, including whole airplanes. Next to each listing is the price the department would be willing to pay. In tasking agents, the CIA can then quote the price tags for each item. Because of this program, the CIA was able to obtain Soviet missiles during the Vietnam War and design ways to beam false signals to disrupt their guidance systems. By knowing what the other side was doing, the CIA was able to provide successive administrations with information that enabled the U.S. to initiate defensive measures and also dispelled fears that might have led to preemptive strikes. The success was there was no war. That was the biggest success, that deterrence actually worked, Edward W. Proctor, who was Deputy Director for Intelligence from 1971 to 1976, said. As the Cold War ended and the Soviet Union and the U.S. inched toward being friends rather than foes, the CIA began to shift its resources from the Soviet East Europe Division into other areas. To coordinate these new priorities, the CIA established special centers to focus the efforts of all the directorates on the latest international problems, terrorism and narcotics.